Hello, and welcome to Screaming in the Cloud, with your host, Chief Cloud Economist at the Duckbill Group, Corey Quinn. This weekly show features conversations with people doing interesting work in the world of cloud, thoughtful commentary on the state of the technical world, and ridiculous titles for which Corey refuses to apologize. This is Screaming in the Cloud.
Couchbase Capella. Database as a service is flexible, full-featured, and fully managed with built-in access via key value, SQL, and full-text search. Flexible JSON documents align to your applications and workloads. Build faster with blazing fast in-memory performance and automated replication and scaling while reducing cost. Capella has the best price performance of any fully managed document database. Visit couchbase.com/screaminginthecloud to try Capella today for free and be up and running in 3 minutes with no credit card required. Couchbase Capella, make your data sing. Today's episode is brought to you in part by our friends at Minio, the high-performance Kubernetes native object store that's built for the multi-cloud. Creating a consistent data storage layer for your public cloud instances, your private cloud instances, and even your edge instances, depending upon what the heck you're defining those as, which depends probably on where you work. It's getting that unified is one of the greatest challenges facing developers and architects today. It requires S3 compatibility, enterprise-grade security and resiliency, the speed to run any workload, and the footprint to run anywhere, and that's exactly what Minio offers. With superb read speeds in excess of 360 gigs and a 100 megabyte binary that doesn't eat all the data you've got on the system, it's exactly what you've been looking for. Check it out today at min.io/download and see for yourself. That's min.io/download, and be sure to tell them that I sent you.
Welcome to Screaming in the Cloud. I'm Corey Quinn. My guest today does something that I sort of dabbled around the fringes of once upon a time, but then realized I wasn't particularly good at it and got the hell out of it and went screaming into clouds instead. Ashley Early is the head of sales here at the Duckbill Group. Ashley, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for coming on and running screaming from my chosen profession.
Let's be clear here. There are two ways that can go because, Sure, I used to dabble around in sales when I was basically trying to figure out how not to starve to death. But I also used to run things, basically a small team. I was managing people and realized I was bad at that too. So really, that's sort of an open-ended direction. We can go either side in, but let's go with sales. That seems like a more interesting way for this to play out. So you've been here for, what is it now? It feels like ages, but my awareness of the passing of time in the middle of a global panini is relatively not great.
Yeah, I think we're at day, 1053 of March 2020. So time is irrelevant. It's a construct. I don't know. But technically, by the Gregorian calendar, I think I'm at 6 months.
It's very odd to me, at least the way that I contextualized doing this. Back when I started what became the Duckbill Group, I was an independent consultant. It was more or less working people I knew through my network who had a very specific, very expensive problem. The AWS bill is too high. And I figured this is genius. It is the easiest possible sale in the world. I'm one of the only scenarios where I can provably demonstrate ROI to a point where, bring me in, you will inherently save money. And all of that is true. But one of the things that I learned very quickly was that even with the easiest sale of, hi, I'd like to sell you this bag of money, there's no such thing as an easy enterprise sale. There is nuance to it. There is a lot of difficulty to it. And I was left with the, I guess, driving question after my first few months of playing this game of, how on earth does anyone make money in this space? I mean, the reason I persisted was basically a bunch of people did favors for me that they didn't owe me at all. It was, oh, great, I'll give them a price quote. And they're like, oh, yeah, so cool. They turned around and quoted that to their boss at triple the rate because don't slit your own throat on this. They were right. And not for nothing. It turns out when you're selling advice, charging more for it makes it likelier to succeed as a project. But I had no idea what I was doing. And like most engineers on Twitter, I look at something I don't understand deeply myself and figure, oh, well, it's not engineering, therefore it's easy. Yeah, it turns out that running a business is humbling across a whole bunch of different axes.
I wouldn't even say it's not running a business. It's working with humans. Working with humans is humbling. If you're working with a machine or even something as simple as like, you're making a product, it's follow a recipe. It's okay. Follow the instructions. I do A, then B, then C, then D, or unless you don't enjoy using the instructions because you don't enjoy using instructions, but you still follow a set general process. You build a thing, it comes out correctly. When the moment that process is talk to this person, then the person A, then person B, then person C, then person D, then back to person A, then person D, and then finally to person E, everything goes to heck in a handbasket. That's what really makes it interesting. And for those of us who are of a certain disposition, we find that fascinating and enthralling. If you're of another disposition, that's hell on earth. So it's a very interesting thing.
Back when I was independent and people tried to sell me things, and yeah, sometimes it worked, it was always interesting going through various intake funnels and the rest. And like, well, what role do you hold in the organization? Do you influence the decision? Do you make the decision? How many people need to be involved in the rest? And I was looking around going, how many people do you think fit in my home office here? Let's be serious. I mean, there are times I escalated to the Chihuahua because she's unpleasant and annoying, and basically sometimes so are people, but that's a separate topic for later. But it became a very different story back as the organizational distance between the people that needed to sign off on a sale increased.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's, you might have felt me squirm when you described those questions, because one of my biggest pet peeves is when people take sales terminology and directly use that with clients. Just like you, if you're an engineer and you're describing what you do, you're not going to go home and explain to your dad in technical jargon what exactly you do. You're going to tell them broad strokes. And then if they're interested, go deeper and deeper, technical, more technical. I hate when salespeople use sales jargon. Like, what's your role in the organization? Are you the decision maker? There are better ways to deal with that. So that's just a sign of poor training. It's not the sales rep's fault. It's this company's fault. Their company's fault. But that's a different thing. It's fascinating to me kind of watching this. What you said spoke of two things there. One is poor training, and two of a lack of awareness of the situation and a lack of just doing a little bit of pre-work. Like, you do 5 seconds of research on Corey Quinn, you can realize that the company is 10, 15 people tops. So it makes sense to ask a question around, hey, do you need anyone else's sign off before we can move forward with this project? That tells me if I need to get someone for technical, for budget, for whatever. But asking if you're a decision maker or if you're influencing or if you're doing initial research, like, that's using sales terminology, not actually getting to the root of the problem, and immediately making it very clear you didn't do any actual research in advance, which is not, in modern selling, not okay.
My business partner, Mike, has a CEO job title, and he'll get a whole bunch of cold outreach constantly, all day, every day. I conducted a 2-week experiment where in front of my chief cloud economist job title, I put CTO/ just to see what would happen. And sure enough, I started getting outreach left, right, up, down, and sideways, not just for things that a CTO figure might theoretically wind up needing to buy, but also job opportunities for a skill set that I haven't dusted off in a decade. So, okay, once people can have something that hits their filters when you're searching for very specific titles, then you wind up getting a lot more outreach. But if you create a job title that no one sensible would ever pick for themselves, suddenly a lot of that tends to go by the wayside. It shined a light on how frustratingly dreary a lot of the sales prospecting work really can be. Side of someone who sits here and gets it. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I say that I did work in sales once upon a time. Not great at it, but one of the first white-collar style jobs that I had was telemarketing, of all things. And I was spectacular at it because I was fortunate enough to be working on a co-branded Affinity credit card that was great. And I had the opportunity to position it as a benefit of an existing membership or something else people already had. I was consistently top 10 out of 400 people on a shift, and it was great. But it was also something that was very time limited. And if you're having an off day, everything winds up crumbling. And eventually I drifted off and started doing different things, but I've never forgotten those days. And that's why it just grinds my gears both to see crappy sales stuff happening and two, watching people on Twitter, particularly taking various sales prospect outreach for a drag. And it's,
oh God, yeah.
You know, not everyone is swimming in the ocean of privilege that some of the rest of us are, and understand that you're just making yourself look like a jerk when you're taking someone who's relatively early career and didn't happen to Google you deeply enough before sending you an email that you find insulting. That bugs me a fair bit.
Yeah, and I think part of that's just a lack of humanity and understanding. Like, there's, I mean, I get it. I'm the first person to be jumping on Twitter and bitching when something goes down or something's not working and saying, you know, I'm the first one to get angry and start complaining. Don't get me wrong. However, what I think a lot of people, it's really easy to dehumanize something you don't see very often or you're not involved in directly. And I find it really interesting. You mentioned you worked in, you know, doing telemarketing. I lasted literally 2 weeks in telemarketing. I full on rage quit. It was a college job. I worked in my college donation center. I lasted 2 weeks and I fully walked out on a shift. I was like, screw this. I'm never doing anything like that ever again. I hate this. But what I hated about it was I hated the lack of connection. I was like, I'm not going to just read some script and get yelled at for having too much banter. Like, do you want, I'm getting money. What do you care? This is, I'm getting more money than other people. Maybe I'm not making as many calls, but I'm getting just as much. So why do you care how I do this? But what really gets me is you have to remember, and I think a lot of people don't understand how kind of most large modern sales organizations work. And just really quickly giving you a very, very generic explanation, the way a lot of organizations work is they employ something called SDRs or sales development reps. They can, that title can be permeated a million different ways. There's ADRs, MDRs, BDRs, whatever. But basically it's their job to do nothing but scour the internet using sometimes actual like scripts. Sometimes they use LinkedIn. Sometimes they purchased databases. So for example, like you might change your title on LinkedIn, but it's not changing in the databases. Trust me, Corey, they have you flagged as a CTO. Sorry.
My personal favorite is when I get cold outreach asking me on the phone call about whether we have any needs for whatever it is they happen to be selling at, and then they name a company that I left in 2012. It's, I don't know how often that database has been sold and resold and sold onwards yet again. And it's just, I work in tech. What do you think the odds are that I'm still in the same job I was 10 years ago? I mean, I get that it happens, but at some point it just becomes almost laughable.
Yeah. If you work at a company that, when in doubt, I tell every sales kind of every kind of team that I work with, do not use list vendors. 90% of them are not very good. They're using old databases. They don't update. You're better off paying for a database that is subscription-based because then they're literally, you've got an SLA on data quality and you can flag and get things fixed. The number one sales data provider, I happen to know for a fact, I actually earned, I think, almost $10,000 in donations to a charity in, what was this? This was 2015, because I went through and did a scrub of our CRM versus I think LinkedIn or something else. And I flagged everything that was inaccurate and sent it back to them. And they happen to have a promotion where for every record you flagged that was inaccurate because they were no longer at the company, they would donate a buck to charity. And I think I sent them like 10,000 or something. People, I was like, none of these are accurate. And they're like, you know, and they sent me this great email, like, thank you for telling us. We really appreciate it. I didn't even know they were doing this promotion. They thought I'd been saving up for it. I was like, no, I just happened to run this analysis and thought you'd want to know. So
it turns out computers are really fast at things.
Yeah. And I was very proud. I figured out how to run a script. I was like, yay, look at me. I wrote a macro. This is very exciting for the first 5 or so years of my sales career. I consistently called myself a dumb salesperson because I was working in really super technical products. I worked for Arista Networks, FireEye, Bromium, Perdix Data. I was working in some pretty reasonably hard tech. And I'd always kind of introduce myself. I definitely talked down about my technical aptitude because I have a degree in political science and opera. These are not technical fields. And yet here I am every day talking about, you know,
well, if the election doesn't pan out the way you want, why don't you sing about it? Why not? You could tie all these things together.
Can. And honestly, there have been several points. I've done a whole other shows on like how those two seemingly completely disparate things have actually been some of the greatest gifts to my career. And most notably, I think, is the fact that I have my degree in political science as a bachelor's of science, which means I have a BS in BS, which is incredibly relevant to my career in a lot of different ways.
This episode is sponsored by our friends at Oracle Cloud. Counting the pennies, but still dreaming of deploying apps instead of Hello World demos? Allow me to introduce you to Oracle's always free tier. It provides over 20 free services and infrastructure, networking, databases, observability, management, and security. And let me be clear here, it's actually free. There's no surprise billing until you intentionally and proactively upgrade your account. This means you can provision a virtual machine instance or spin up an autonomous database that manages itself, all while gaining the networking, load balancing, and storage resources that somehow never quite make it into most free tiers needed to support the application that you want to build. With Always Free, you can do things like run small-scale applications or do proof-of-concept testing without spending a dime. You know that I always like to put asterisk next to the word free. This is actually free, no asterisk. Start now. Visit snark.cloud/OCI-free. That's snark.cloud/OCI-free.
Yeah, so wrapping up kind of how modern sales organizations work, most companies employ things called BDRs, and they're typically people who have less than 5 years of sales experience. They rightly or wrongly tend to be people in their early 20s who have very little training. Most people get SDRs on the phones within a week. Which means that
these are the people that are doing the cold outreach.
Product training.
These are the people who are doing the cold outreach.
These are the people who are doing the cold outreach. So their whole job is just to get appointments for account execs. Account execs, and they get, again, tons of different names, but these are the closers. They'll run you through the sales cycle. They typically have between 5 and 30 years of experience, but they're the ones, depending on how big your company is. So the bigger your company, typically the more experience your sales rep's going to have. In terms of managing those separate deal cycles. But what that ends up happening is you end up with this SDR organization. This is where I've spent most of my career, is helping people build healthy sales development organizations. It turns into this churn and burn culture where you've got people coming in and basically flaming out because they go on Twitter or, heaven forbid, Reddit and get sales advice from these loudmouth, terrible people who are telling them to do things that didn't work 10 years ago, but they then go try it, they send it out, and then their prospect suddenly blasting them on Twitter. It's not that rep's fault that they got no training in the first place. They got no support. They just had to figure it out because that's the culture. It's the company's fault. And a lot of times people don't, there was a big push against this last year, I think, within the sales community against other sales leaders doing it, but now it's starting to spread out. Like, I have no problem dragging someone for a really terrible email. Anonymize the company, anonymize the email. And if you want to give feedback, give it to them directly. And you can also say, I'm going to post this, but it's not coming back to you. And tell them,
whenever
like, get out
I get
of that
outreach
terrible company.
From, yeah. Whenever I get outreach from AWS for a sales motion or for recruiting or whatnot, I always anonymize the heck out of the rep. And I never, but I, and it's funny to me because it's, don't you know who I am? It is humorous on some level. And it's clear that it's a numbers game and they're trying to do a bunch of different things, but a cursory Google of my name would show it. It's just amusing. I want to be clear that whenever I do that, I don't think the rep has done anything wrong. They're doing exactly what they should. I just find it very funny that, wait, me work at an AWS, the bookstore? It seems like it would be a... Yeah, the juxtaposition is just hilarious to me. They've done nothing wrong, and that's okay. It's a hard racket. I remember, at least they had the benefit over my first enterprise sales job, where I was selling tape drives into the AS400 market, competing against IBM on price. That was in the days of no one ever gets fired for buying IBM. So yeah, the place you want to save money on is definitely the backup system that's going to save all of your systems. I made one sale in my time there. It apparently set a company record because it wasn't specifically aimed at the AS400. And I did the math on that and realized, I'd have to do two of these a month in order to beat the draw against commission structure that they had. So I said, the hell with this, and I quit. The CEO was very much a sales bro, and, well, you need to figure out whether you're a salesperson or not. And even back then, I had an attitude problem, and it was, I know that I am. It's just the question is, am I going to be a salesperson here? And the answer is no. It's a two-way street.
It is. And I say this all the time to people who, I work with a lot of salespeople now who are like, I don't think sales is for me. I don't know. I didn't work. I did past three companies, didn't work. The answer isn't, is sales for you? The answer is, are you selling the right thing at the right place? And one of the things we've learned from the Great Recession and the Great Reshuffling and everything is there's no reason to stay at a terrible company. And there's no reason to stay at a company where you're not really passionate about and understand what you're selling. I joked about, I talked down about myself the first bit of my career. Doesn't mean I didn't, I might not understand exactly how heuristics work, but I understand what heuristics are. Just don't ask me to design any of them. You know, like you have to understand and you have to be really excited about it. And that's what modern sales is. And so, yes, you're going to get a ton of the outreach because that's how people, it still works. That's why we all still get Nigerian Prince emails. Somebody somewhere still clicks those things, sadly. And that gets me really angry.
It's a pure numbers game.
Exactly. Most 90% of enterprise B2B sales is not that anymore. Even the companies that are using BDRs, which is most of them, are now moving to what's called account-based selling. We're using hyper-personalized messaging. You're probably noticing videos are popping up more. I'm a huge fan of video. I think it's a great way to force personalization. Where it's like, hi, Corey, I see you. I'm talking to you. I've done my research. I know what you're doing at the DuckBill Group. And here's how I think we can help. If that's not the case, no worries. Let me know. I'll leave you alone.
I have yet to receive one of those, but I'm sure it'll happen now that I've mentioned that and put that out in the universe.
Probably.
What always drove me nuts, and maybe this is unfair, but when I'm trying to sign to use a product, probably something SaaS-based, and I see this a lot, where first, if you aren't letting me self-serve and get off with a free tier and just start testing something, well, that's already a ding against you because usually I'm figuring this out at 2 o'clock in the morning when I can't sleep and I want to work on something. I don't want to wait for a sales cycle and have to slow things down. Cool. But at some point for sophisticated customers, you absolutely need to have a sales conversation, but okay, great. Usually I encounter this more with lead magnets or other things designed to get my contact info, but it drives me up a wall when they start demanding information that is very clearly trying to classify me in their sales funnel on some level. I'll give you my name, my company, and my work email address. Although I would think that from my work email address, you could probably figure out where I work and the rest. But then there's other questions. How big is your company? What is your functional role within the company? And where are you geographically? Well, that's an interesting question. Why does that matter in 2022? Well, very often leads get circulated out to people based upon geography. And I get it, but it also frustrates me just because I don't want to have to deal with classifying and sorting myself out for what is going to be a very brief conversation with a salesperson. Because if the product works, great, I'm going to buy. If it doesn't work, I'm going to get frustrated and not want to hear from you forever. Which gets to my big question for you, and please don't take the question as anything other than the joking spirit in which it's intended. But why are so many salespeople profoundly annoying?
I would...
Sales processes is probably the better way to frame it.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, yeah, it's not the people's fault, the processes.
As we've talked about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, okay, I think it's less the people, more the processes. And
it,
processes
it expresses itself as the same person showing up again and again, that is not totally their fault. That is the process by which they are being measured as a part of their job. And it's unfair to blame them for that. But the expression is, this person's annoying the hell out of me.
Oh my gosh, why does she keep showing up in my inbox? Leave me alone. Just let me freaking test it. I said, I needed 2 weeks. Just let me have the 2 weeks to freaking test the thing. I will get back to you. Yeah, no, I know. And even since moving into leadership several years ago, same thing. I'm like, okay, no, like I've gotten to the point where I've had several conversations with salespeople. I'm like, I know the game. I know what you're trying to do. I respect it. Leave me alone. I promise I will get back to you. I've literally said this to people. And the weird thing is most salespeople respect that. We really respect the transparency on that. Now, the trick is what you're talking about with lead capture and stuff like this. Again, it comes down to company design, and it comes down to companies who value the buyer experience and the customer journey and companies who don't. And this, I think, is actually more driven by, in my humble opinion, our slightly over-reliance on venture capital, which is all about gathering as much data as possible, figuring out how to monetize it, move from there. In their mind, personal experience and emotion doesn't really factor into that equation very much. So you end up with these buyer journeys that are less about the buyer and more about getting them from click to purchase as efficiently as possible in terms of company resources, which includes salespeople time. So as to why you have to fill out all those things, that just to me reeks of a company that maybe doesn't really understand the client experience and probably is going to have a pretty support program as well, which means the product better be really freaking good for me to buy it.
To be clear, at the DuckBill Group, we do not have a 2 in the morning click here and get you on board. It turns out that we have yet to really see the value in building a shopping cart system where you can buy one consulting, please, and call it good. We're not quite at the level of productizing our offering yet, and having conversations is a necessary part of what we do. But that also aligns with our customer expectation, where there is not a general expectation in this industry that you can buy a full-on bespoke consulting engagement without talking to a human being. That, honestly, if someone's trying to sell someone such a thing, I would be terrified
Yeah, run screaming. Good Lord. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's one of the things, like, one of the reasons I love working with this team and I love this problem is because this isn't a quick, you know, download, install, and save 10% on your AWS bill by installing DuckBill Group. It ain't that simple. If it were that simple, like, AWS wouldn't have the market cap it does. So that's one of the things I love. I love really meaty problems that don't have clean answers and specifically don't have answers that look slightly different for everybody. I love those sort of problems. I've done the highly productized stuff, click here, buy, get in on the free tier, and then it's all about upsell, cross-sell as needed. Been there, done that. That's fun. And that's a whole different bucket of challenges. But what we're dealing with every single day on the consulting side of DuckBill Group is far more nuanced and far more exciting because we're also seeing some truly incredible architecture designs, like companies who are really on the bleeding edge of what they're doing. And it's just
cost
really
and architecture
fun.
Are the same thing in the cloud. It's a blast to see it.
It's so much fun. It's the world's best jigsaw puzzle because it covers like every single continent and all these different nuances. And you got to think about ephemerality, which is my new favorite word.
It's so fun because you are building a sales team here, which opens up a few interesting avenues for me. For one, I don't have to manage and yell at individual salespeople in the same way. For example, we talk about it being a process and not a person thing. We're launching some outbound sales work and basically having the person to talk to about that process, namely you, means that I don't need to be hovering over people's shoulders the way I felt that I once did. As far as what are we sending people? These passive aggressive drip campaigns of clearly you don't mind lighting money on fire. If that changes, please let me know. It's email 8 in a sequence. This stuff has an implicit love, Mike and Corey, at the bottom of everything that comes out of this company. And it represents us in some respect. And let's be clear, we have a savvy, sophisticated, and more attractive than the average audience listening to all of these shows. And they'll eat me alive if we start doing stuff like that. Not to mention that I find it not particularly respectful of their time and who they are. It doesn't work. So we have to be very conscious of that. And the fact that I never had to explain that concept in any depth to you made bringing you in one of the easiest decisions we've ever made.
Well, I think it helped that I think in one of my interviews, I went off on the alligator email, which is this infamous email we've all gotten, which is basically like, you know, hi, I haven't heard from you yet. So I want to know which one of these three scenarios has happened to you. One, you're not interested in my product, but didn't have the balls to email me and say that you're not interested. Two, you're no longer in this position, in which case you're not going to read this email anyway. Or three, you're being chased by an alligator and I should call animal control because you need help. This email was
hilarious.
Yeah. And there's variations of it. And I've seen variations of it that are very well done and are on brand and work with the company. I've seen variations of that could be legitimately, I think, great humor. And that's great. Humor in emails and humor in sales is fantastic. I have to shout out my friend John Seelig up in Canada, who actually literally does workshops on how sales teams can integrate humor into their prospecting. It's freaking brilliant. But
near and dear to my heart.
If you're not actually trained in that stuff, don't do it. Don't do the alligator email. But I think I went off on that during one of our interviews just because I was just sick of seeing these things. And what kills me, again, it comes back to the beginning. It's people who have no training, no experience coming in. I mean, it really kills me too because there's a real concerted effort in the sales community to get more diverse people into sales to kind of kill the sales bro just by washing them out, basically. And so we're recruiting hard with veterans, with Black and other racial minority groups, LGBTQ communities, all sorts of things, indigenous peoples. And so we're bringing people that also are maybe a little bit more mature, a little bit older, have families they're supporting, and we're throwing them into roles with no support and very little training. And then they wash out and we wonder why. It's like, well, maybe because you didn't. It's like when I explain this to other people who aren't in sales, like really, it's like imagine coming into being hired for a coding job, being told you're going to be trained on, you know, Ruby on Rails or C# or whatever it is we're currently using. My references are probably super outdated. But then being given a book and that's it and told, learn it. And by the way, your first project's due in a month.
For a lot of folks, that's how we learned in the engineering spaces. But let's be clear, the people who do well in that generally have tailwinds of privilege at their back. They don't have headwinds of, you suck at this. It was the, you're born on third, you didn't hit a triple style of a school of thought. The idea of building an onboarding pipeline, of making this stuff more accessible to people earlier on is incredibly important. One of my I guess, awakening moments as we were building this company was it turns out that if you manage salespeople as if they were engineers, it doesn't go super well. Whereas if you manage engineers like they're salespeople, they quit, rage quit, cry, and call you out as being an abusive manager. One of the best descriptions I ever heard from an advisor was that salespeople are sharks, but that's not intended to be unkind. It is simply a facet of their nature. They enjoy the hunt. They enjoy chasing things down, and they like playing games. And whereas as soon as you start playing games with your engineers on how much money they're going to make this week, that turns out to be a very negative thing. It's a different mindset. It's about motivating people as whatever, as befits what it is that they want to be doing.
It is. And it's also, the other thing is it's a cultural conditioning. So it's really interesting you say, you know, people, you know, playing games. We do enjoy, there's definitely some enjoyment of the competition. There's a thrill of the hunt. Absolutely. But at the same time, you want your salespeople to quit, screw with their money. You screw with our money, we will bill so fast, it'll make your head spin. So it's like people think, oh, we love this. It's really more, think of it as we're gamblers.
Yeah. To be clear, when I say playing games with money, I'm talking about the idea of sell to a company in this profile this quarter and we'll throw a $5,000 bonus your way or something like that. It is the business wants to see something, great, make it worth the sales team's while to pursue it, or don't be surprised when no one really cares that much about those things. It's all upside. It is not about, and if you don't sell to this weird thing that I can't really describe effectively to you, we're going to cut your bet. Yeah, that goes over like a lead balloon, as it should. Money, my belief is that compensation should always go up, not down.
Yeah, no, it should. And it's, aside from that, here's a fun stat. I believe this came out of Forrester, it might have been out of Topo. I apologize. I don't remember exactly who said this, but a recent study found that less than 68% of sales reps make their quota every month. So imagine that, where we have this thing called OTE, which is on target earnings. So if you have this number you're supposed to take home every month, only 68% of sales reps actually do that every month. So that means that we live with this number as our target, but we're living and budgeting anywhere from 30 to 50% below that, and then hoping and doing the work that goes from there. That's what we've been conditioned to accept. And that's why you end up with sales reps that are, use terms like shark, and are aggressive and are in your face and are, and can keep it, we call
it,
I love
it. I didn't realize it was pejorative.
I know. No, but here's the thing too, but somebody called it commission breath, which I love. But it's like, you can smell commission breath coming off us when we're desperate. You totally can. It's because of this antiquated way of building commissions. And this is something that it just was really obvious to me. And apparently I was a little bit ahead of the curve. When I started designing comp plans, everyone told me, you want to design a comp plan, tie it to what you want them to do very specifically. So if you want them to move a pen, design the comp plan that they get a buck when they put the pen from the heel of your hand to the tips of your fingers, then they get a buck. And then they can just do that repeatedly. That's literally how I was taught to design comp plans. In my head, that meant that I need to design it in such a way that it's doable for my team, because I don't want my team worrying about how they're going to put food on the table while they're talking to a client, because then they're going to get commission breath and it'll piss off the client. That's not a good client experience. That's not going to lead to good performance.
Yeah. My concerns as a business owner have nothing to do with salespeople making too much money. In fact, I am never happier than I am than paying out commissions. The concern then therefore has to become okay, great. How do I keep the salespeople from being inadvertently incentivized to sell something for $10 that cost me $12 to fulfill? It's a question of what behaviors do you incentivize that align what they're motivated by with what the company needs. And very often getting that wrong, which happens from time to time, is not viewed as a learning experience that it should be, but instead they're just out to screw us. And I've seen so many company owners get so annoyed whenever their salespeople outperform. It's, well, what did you expect? That is the positive outcome, as opposed to what? The underperforming sales rep who can't close a deal? Please.
Well, no, and let's think about this too, especially if it's tied to commission and you're paying out commission. It's like, okay, commission is always some sort of percentage, depending on a lot of different things, but some sort of percentage of what they're bringing in. So if you design a comp plan that has you paying out more in commission than the sales that were earned to bring it in, that's on you. You screwed up, and you need to either be honest and say, I screwed up, I can't pay this, and know that you're going to lose some sales reps, but you won't lose as many as if you just refuse to pay it. But honestly, I'm not even kidding. I know people. I've worked at a company that I happen to know did this, that literally fired people because they didn't have the money to pay out the commission. And oof, because they fired them before the commission was due to be paid out, then that person no longer had a legal claim to it. That's common. Yeah. So the commission
goes
both ways. To be
clear, we have never done that. But I also would say that if we had, that's a screaming red flag for a consultancy, given the nature of what it is that we do here. It turns out that when we're building out comp plans, we model out various scenarios. Like, what is the worst way that this could wind up unfolding? And okay, in some of our early drafts, it's, it turns out that we would not be able to pay salaries because we wound up giving all of that in commission to people with an uncapped upside. Okay, great. But we're also not going to cap people's commissions because that winds up being a freaking problem. So how do we wind up motivating in a way that continues to grow and continues to incentivize the behaviors we want? And it turns out it's super complicated. It's why we brought you in. It's easier.
Yeah, it's a pain. But the other side of this too, I think, is there's another force at play here, which is finance. A lot of traditional finance modeling is built around that 50 to 70% of people hit commission. So if all of a sudden you design a comp plan in such a way that 100% of the team is hitting commission, finance loses their shit. So you have to make sure that when you're designing these things, one of the things I learned this the hard way. This is how I learned that not everyone does it this way. I built my first comp plan. My team's hitting it. My team's overperforming, not a ton, but we're doing really well. All of a sudden I'm getting called to finance and getting raked over the coals. And they're like, what did you do? And I'm like, what do you mean? What did I do? I designed a comp plan. We're hitting goal. Why are you mad? Well, we only had this much budgeted for commission. And I was like, that's not my fault. Well, that's what historic performance was. Okay, well, that's not what we're going to do going forward. We're going to do this. And they're like, oh, well, you need to notify us if you're going to change it like that. And I was like, wait a minute. You modeled so that my team would not hit OTE. Yes. That's how you've always done this. Yes. Okay, well, that's not what we're going to do going forward. And if that's a problem, I'll go find a door. Because no. And especially when we're talking about people who are living in extremely expensive areas. I spent most of my career living and working in San Francisco, managing teams of people who made less than six figures. And that's rough when you're paying $2,000 in rent every month and 60% of your pay is commission. Like, nah, you need to know that money's coming. So modern, I talk about modern sales a lot because that's the word I'm trying to use, because there's like the Glengarry, Glenn Ross kind of Wolf of Wall Street school, which is not how anyone behaves anymore. And if you're in an environment that's like that or that treats your salespeople like that, please leave. And then you've got modern sales, which is all about, okay, let's figure out how we can set up our salespeople to be the best people they can be, to give our clients the best experience they can. That's where you get top performance out of. And that's where you never run into the terrible emails with the alligators and the clearly you like lighting, you know, piles of money on fire. That's where you don't get emails to Corey Quinn asking him if he's interested in coming to work for AWS, the book company. It's by incentivizing the people and creating good humans where they can really thrive as salespeople and as people in general. The rest comes with time. But it's this whole new way of looking at things. And it's big and it's scary and it costs more upfront, but you get more on the back end every single time.
Not that you care about this an awful lot, but you have your own podcast that talks about this, The Other Side of Sales. What inspired you to decide not just to build sales teams through a different lens, but also to, you know what? I'm going to go out and talk into microphones to the internet from time to time, which, let's be clear, takes a little bit of a certain warped perspective. I say this myself, having done this far too often.
Yeah, no, it's a fun little origin story. So I'm a huge Star Trek geek, obsessive. And I was listening to a Star Trek podcast run by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to run a Star Trek podcast called The Greatest Generation. Definitely not safe for work, but a really good podcast if you're into Star Trek at all. And they always do kind of letters at the end of the shows. And one of the letters at the end of a show one day was, hey, I was really inspired by you guys. And I started my own podcast on this random thing that I'm super excited about. And I'm literally driving in the car with my husband. And I'm like, I don't know why I'm not listening to sales podcasts. I listen to enough of these other random ones. Jump online, pulled up a list of sales podcasts. And I think I went through three or four articles of like every sales podcast that was big. And this was like January of 2019.
By Broseph McBroerson, but everyone calls him Broey. Yeah.
Literally, there was Conversations with Women in Sales with the late, great, the amazing Lori Richardson, who's now with it, but she took over for a mentor of mine who passed in 2020, sadly. And but there was that, and then there was one other that was hosted by a husband wife team, and that was it out of like 30 podcasts. And so it was this moment of like epiphany of like, I could start my own podcast, and oh, probably need to, because literally no one looks or sounds like someone who I'd actually want to hang out with ever or do business with in a lot of cases. And that's really changed. I'm so grateful. But really what it came down to was I didn't feel like there was a podcast for me. There wasn't a podcast I could listen to about sales that could help me, that I felt like I identified with. So I was like, all right, fine, I'll start my own. I called up a friend and she was literally going through the same thing at the same time. So we said, screw it, we'll do our own. Like we went full bender from Futurama. We're like, screw it, we'll have our own podcast with liquor and heels and honest conversations about that happens to us every day and random stuff. It's a lot of fun. And we've gone through a few iterations and it's been a long journey. We're about to hit our 100th episode, which is really exciting. But yeah, the other side of sales is on a mission to make B2B sales culture truly inclusive so everyone can thrive. So our conversations are all interviews with amazing sales pros who are trying to do amazing things and who are I think we're over 90% are from a minority background, which is really exciting to kind of try and shift that conversation from Brosif Miss Broerson. Our original tagline was the anti-sales bro podcast, but we thought that was a little too antagonistic. So
yeah, being a little too antagonistic is generally my failure mode. So I hear you on that. I really want to thank you for taking so much time out of your day to speak with me because, well, not that I should thank you. It's one of those, I should really turn around and say, wait a minute, why aren't you selling things? Why are you still talking to me? But no, I do appreciate your... Exactly. I think that's a different podcast. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to learn more, where's the best place to find you?
Well, definitely please go check out DuckBillGroup.com. We would love to talk with you about anything to do with your AWS bill. Got a ton of resources on there around how to get that managed and sorted. If you're interested in connecting with me, you can always hit me up at, I'm on Twitter at Ashley at Work, which is another deep cut Star Trek reference. Or you can hit me up at LinkedIn, just search Ashley Early. My name is spelled a little weird because I'm a little weird. It's A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H. And then early, like early in the morning.
And links to all of that will wind up in the show notes. Thanks so much for your time. It's appreciated.
This has been fun. We'll do it again soon.
Ashley Early, head of sales here at the DuckBill Group. I'm cloud economist Corey Quinn, and this is Screaming in the Cloud. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Whereas if you've hated this podcast, please leave a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice, along with an angry comment. I'm going to get so many angry comments that I'm then going to get angry that everyone did exactly what I incentivized them to do and die mad about it. If your AWS bill keeps rising and your blood pressure is doing the same, then you need the DuckBill Group. We help companies fix their AWS bill by making it smaller and less horrifying. The DuckBill Group works for you, not AWS. We tailor recommendations to your business and we get to the point. Visit DuckBillGroup.com to get started.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.